May the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in your sight. O Lord, my strength and my redeemer. It's kind of been a sad week, hasn't it? Unless you've been hiding under a rock, you've heard somewhere along the line that we've lost influential pastor and Christian leader this week, Tim Keller. There's another one that we lost that you probably don't know, a guy by the name of Harry Reeder. Harry was the pastor of Briarwood Presbyterian Church in Birmingham, Alabama. Both Keller and Reeder were huge supports to me personally in different seasons in my life. Harry was a practical help. When I was living in Scotland, I was trying to get a health and revitalization ministry going, and Harry gave me resources, a lot of resources, access to his team, and he even committed tens of thousands of dollars to our ministry. Interestingly, just as an aside, one of the key members of Harry's team was a guy by the name of Lynn Downing. So you recognize that last name? That's Jason Downing's uncle. Small world. When I reconnected with In Town a few years ago, I met this Jason Downing. I said, any relation to Lynn Downing? He said, my uncle. So there we go. Harry was a big blessing to me, and he passed away in a car accident this week. Harry and I didn't see eye to eye on everything. But that doesn't stop me from grieving deeply his passing and all the good that came to me through him. It was a wonderful season in my life in Scotland, not just because of people like Harry Reeder and his team, but also because of Keller. And Keller's influence was not the same sort of personal and practical help, but it was clear to me at that time I needed some growth. I needed growth in faith and in preaching. And I decided to find a couple of preachers who were particularly gifted communicators. And I resolved to listen to everything that I could from them. And Keller was one of them. And at first I was listening to analyze the delivery of the sermon, and I wanted to see how they structured their sermons, all that stuff that lie behind what you hear on Sundays. But it wasn't long, days maybe, that I found myself almost entirely disinterested in all of that. And I was just listening. And I was just hearing it. And I found myself changing over time. I'll forever associate particular locations in Edinburgh with the sermons I was listening to from Keller at the time. They had such an impact. After the Sandy Hook massacre in 2012, I had to stand in front of our congregation and say something of comfort, and also say something about how to think about the existence of God, or even the God we worship, in the face of horrendous evils such as that one. And when the day was over, it occurred to me that Keller's thoughts and voice were in the background of what I had said. May I be honest with you? Anything I've ever said from a pulpit or a lectern, I have received from someone else. I have nothing original to offer you. I'm sorry. I may have praised it in words that sound like me, that sound like Jason Curtis. But I've received all of them from someone else, be it someone recent or down through the millennia since Christ, even Christ himself for that matter. All of it has been gifted to me. Truth is, Keller would tell you the same thing. So would every other preacher, I hope, would tell you that. We know that everything we have to offer the world has been given to us. It is a gift. St. Paul says in 1 Corinthians, what do you have that you have not received from God? And if everything you have is from God, why boast as though it were not a gift? It's one of St. Augustine's favorite texts. What a gift Tim and Harry have been to me and to so many. And that's the way the Christian faith is. All the way down, every aspect of life with God, even the message of the good news itself, is a gift. I wasn't born a Christian. Someone had to speak the good news to me. Because it's nothing that I would come up with on my own. That's true for me, and that's true for you too. God's gifts to me have been many. And some of the best are in this room right now. You know, one of the strangest traditions we have in our world is to ask each other what gift we want for Christmas or our birthday. Have you ever thought about how odd this is? What do you want for your birthday? A gift, it seems to me, is something that's given to us purely on the basis of the generosity and the goodwill of another person. In other words, it's something that we wouldn't have bought for ourselves, or perhaps even thought to have bought, if that person hadn't given it to us. A gift, then, is more about the one who gives it than the one receiving it. So when we ask someone what they want for Christmas or their birthday, and then we go out and we purchase it for them, or we order it from Amazon or whatever, it feels to me like we're just running an errand for them. You know? Now, I know, those of you who like to send emails, I know we're still purchasing it, blah, blah, blah. I get that. But still, when we operate like this, I'm not sure it's a gift in the truest sense of that term. At least not in the way that the Bible intends the term. When God talks about a gift, he's talking about something we wouldn't have come up with on our own. Salvation is a gift from God, is the gift from God. But nobody's looking for the sort of salvation that God brings. At least not salvation wrapped up in the person of an ancient male Jew who lived briefly, died violently, rose unexpectedly, and then disappeared by means of a plow. At least not that kind of salvation. Nobody's looking for that. It doesn't hold a lot of mass appeal. This week I was driving around Portland and I saw a bumper sticker. There's a headline for you. I saw a bumper sticker in Portland, right? And it said, I've never seen this one. It said, I may be a monster, but at least I'm not a Christian. Interesting, isn't it? I was really taken aback. I stared at the car. I stared at the person. I almost hit someone else. Like, what is the sort of person who's saying this? I need to know more. I wanted to talk to them. Welcome to Portland, right? I don't know everything that person intended to communicate, but this one is for sure. There's nothing about the good news of the Christian faith that carries any appeal to her. At least not in the way I just outlined it for you a minute ago. That sort of gospel is alien to the average Portlander. It's the sort of gift they would never think to ask for. And that's the way the gospel is. It comes to us from the outside. It invades our space. And even though we can't explain everything about it, and even though there are aspects of it that don't make much sense to us, when you live with it for a while and you listen carefully to it, we discover that the gospel of Jesus, the gospel of the Christian faith, turns out to be the greatest gift that we never knew we wanted. In our reading of Acts, Jesus promises the disciples a gift unlike any they could have dreamed up for themselves. Never would have thought. I love reading about the disciples, don't you? They make me feel good about myself. The more I read about them, the more ignorance they spout, the more comfort it gives me. How much ignorance have I so confidently shared over the years? Only God knows. I don't know what to tell you. It's been a lot. People have reminded me over the years, and in the present day, that I spout a lot of ignorance, and that's true. But here we are with the disciples. And they ask the Lord again, right before he goes to heaven, Lord, is now the time you're going to restore the kingdom to Israel? They're beginning to sound like children who ask questions when you're in a car on a long road trip, right? Are we there yet? Can I watch a show on the iPad? Turn on some music? Turn off that music? Where are the snacks? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? And kids ask all these questions in spite of the fact that their very wise and patient parents have given them the information repeatedly. Just like Jesus. He must have been exasperated with these guys. He's been telling them for years now that he was going to die, that he was going to come back from the dead, and that he would be returning to the Father. He gave them the plan multiple times. And now in Acts 1, he's on the other side of death and resurrection. So two-thirds of that, the event as a whole, of all those events, has taken place. And they're not connecting any dots. You would have thought, they would have thought about some of those things that he had said, and that they would have connected some dots, and they wouldn't be asking silly questions. But no. Lord, are you going to overrun Pilate and Caesar now? Can we sit on the throne next to you? How long till we rule the whole world? Are we there yet, Lord? I love Jesus' response. It also gives me comfort. You're operating on a need-to-know basis. That's basically what he said. Stop asking stupid questions. It's in the Greek. Questions about times and dates and seasons and who will do what and when and how it all fits together and what makes sense and what doesn't. None of that matters. You are operating on a need-to-know basis. Go to Jerusalem and wait. I love that. I wonder if Jesus lacked a little confidence right before he went back to the Father when they asked him this question and he just had to say, be quiet, go to Jerusalem and wait. I wonder if this mission is going to be accomplished. Go and wait. My Father will give you a gift. The gift is named Holy Spirit. Believe me, Jesus says, the Spirit's not a gift you would have thought to ask for. The gift is going to come to you, and he's going to come in great power, more than you can imagine. It's not the sort of power you can control and use against Pilate and Caesar for your own ends. It's a power who will work through you so that God gets the world he wants, not so that you get the world you want. That is crucial for the church to remember, right? And that's it. That's what Jesus said. Just wait, and I'll give you this gift. And the Spirit will push you along in the right direction. And he will tell you what to say. And he will even teach you new things that even I haven't said to you. You don't need all the answers to your questions right now. You just need my gift, Holy Spirit. And I'm giving you that gift. And I'm giving you that gift by going away. This is the glory. This is part of the glory of the ascension. The glory of the ascension is the departure of Jesus so that the Spirit can come and give us that kind of power to carry on his work. It's a remarkable reality, the church, isn't it? In spite of all of our ignorance and arrogance and bickering and division, the Spirit of God is the gift that continues to bring God's kingdom on earth just as it is in heaven through weak, faltering, sinful people like we are. Without the Spirit, the church would simply be another human institution that comes and goes. In fact, we would have gone a long time ago, no doubt, without the presence and power of the Spirit. And that's it. That's what Jesus says. That's the gift you need. So what does that tell you? It tells me that what he's given us is enough. Obeying his commands and having the Spirit is enough. The scene in Acts 1 really is comical, isn't it? Most of the time in the Bible, when God needs angels to share his message with someone, how many does he send? One. Gabriel to Mary, remember? One angel will show up, give a message, go away, most of the time. I mean, why send more, really? On this occasion, two. Two angels show up. Luke tells us what they said, and what they said together. I'm not sure how they said that. I think about these sorts of strange things. Did they say it in unison? Were they standing on either side so the disciples were sure to hear it so that nobody said, hey, can you repeat that? I don't know. Were they going back and forth antiphonally, line by line? I have no idea. Does Luke just mean this is what the message was from the angels? I'm not sure, but there were two. Why did God feel the need to send two at this time? And then, what a strange question for them to ask. I envision the scene because the disciples are staring into the sky, and Luke says, suddenly two men appeared there. So it's like in a movie where somebody's staring and the camera doesn't show the other person that has walked up next to that person, and then the camera pans out and the other guy's there and look at him and go, oh, when did you get here? It's like that. They just appear standing there. And then, of course, the question, why are you staring in the sky? I mean, isn't that obvious? Isn't it manifestly obvious why they were staring in the sky? Wouldn't you be? But then that's it. That's all we hear. Luke records no verbal response to the angels from the disciples. He doesn't say what the angels did next. And the disciples, in response to this most incredible event, just walked back to Jerusalem. And they joined with the women, including Mary, the mother of Jesus. And they constantly prayed, Luke says. And that's it. I don't know why Luke wanted to name who was there either. But it's interesting that everyone gets named here. In so many other places, the disciples go unnamed. But here, they get listed out to tell us, maybe, just a handful of people. They just obeyed Jesus. They just went back. And then just prayed and waited. What a strange story. There's a lot that's been written on the ascension. We only have a couple of minutes. I just want to highlight one aspect of it. What do we make of all of it? It would have been very easy for the disciples to despair at Jesus' ascension. He had even reassured them that he would not leave them as orphans, because I believe he knew they would be afraid about that. So they would have been very sad. His departure meant a great deal of uncertainty for them. His instructions to go to Jerusalem and wait for a gift didn't sound reassuring. His absence and their ignorance put them very much on shaky ground. And we don't really like operating. We very much like operating on an I-know-everything basis, not a need-to-know basis. We want Jesus and his Spirit to fit into our tidy, compact, easy-to-control box so that we have all the answers and we know the plan. That's the way we get our heads around this Jesus and church business. Some of us like a lot of knowledge. It helps us understand the world, helps us understand ourselves, our present culture. We like having insights like that. Some of us like to meet with a friend or talk to someone on the phone and analyze everything that's going on in the broader church world or in the political scene, and we like to come up with all the right answers in that phone call, and that sort of reassures us, like, yes, now we're in the know. Now, we might not do anything about that information, but we like to know it. We like to be on the inside. We like to know that we are connected right to Jesus. We're being faithful to the scriptures. I call these people sort of the word and sacrament people, right? That's what they dial into. How are we worshiping? Do we have our doctrine nice and tight and tidy? Word and sacrament guys. Others of us are people of action. We want to know the plan. We want to know how we're going to get from A to B. When we're going to do it. Who's going to make the decisions. How we're going to get there. If we don't have a good plan, everything's at risk. We want to know what action we should take, and we want to do it. And if the church isn't on the move, taking action in some productive way, well then, we're not being the church, right? I've been told that on a number of times. People say to me, if the church is not serving the community, we are not being the church. Okay, so they're people of action. Some of us like the times, some of us like the seasons, as it were, if those categories aren't artificial. Some of us like to know, some of us want to do, and there's a tension in the church around all of that. And Jesus says here, you don't need to be preoccupied with knowing everything that you don't know now, or knowing exactly what the plan is. You need to do what I have told you to do. Obey me and wait for the greatest gift you never knew you wanted. Now, let me be clear. I'm not saying understanding the times is wrong or wasted time. I'm not saying that taking action is unneeded and we should be content with quiet passivity. I'm not suggesting either of those things. What I am saying is that all of that is subject to the gift of the Spirit, who takes us to places that we would never go on our own. So you think about Acts. One day the Spirit brings Pentecost, and 3,000 people are saved and added to the church. Glorious, right? The disciples must have thought, if this is the way it's going to be, I'm all in. And then that same Spirit sits with us in a jail in Philippi and lets us languish there a while we pray and we sing. And that Spirit directs us to a place where we will encounter suffering and struggle and uncertainty. And what we discover very quickly is that we can't figure out God's plans. Nor will we be able to answer all the why questions that plague us. Those are efforts to get at the times and the dates. There is no need to fret that mystery characterizes our journey. Why are you staring at the heavens? Jesus will come again. Now you will have the Spirit, and He will be the gift that you need to move forward. What about us in town? What's in store for us? Think about our history a little bit. Those of you who have been here for a while. At InTown, you've seen times of great spiritual and even numerical growth. I imagine you still grieve the loss of those times, right? It meant a lot to you. They were formative in your faith, weren't they? Remember those days, Pete, right? We've also seen a lot of times at In Town of pain and loss. And in all of it, I think it's crucial to remember that what we need the most is not to discern exactly what the plan is or to get all the information we need and then finally we'll be a church. What we need is prayerful expectation and then respond to where the Spirit is taking us. What we are doing in this room on Sundays is not a waste of our time. What we are doing in praying for what God would have us do for our community is not a waste of time. And engaging in that is not a waste of time. And then the Spirit gets to decide whatever it is we become. We go to Jerusalem, we wait, as it were. The Spirit comes, we respond. And then God does with us what He wants us to do. And some days, it might be a Pentecost-like event, and other days, we may be in a jail in Philippi, praying and singing, and then that's just it. But it's so God gets the world that He wants, right? It's really important in this phase of our life as a church, we're just talking as a family, that we hold these things loosely. That we make sure that we are not the ones grinding an axe or driving our own agenda, but that we are genuinely open to what God has for us. Where does He want us to go? What does it need to look like? How will we get there? Spirit of God, come. Show us, guide us, and then give us faith and the grace to follow You all the way to the end. Thanks for